Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing about the new lifeboat station at Brighton Marina, and also about a series of films on great artists of the past, made by local filmmaker Phil Grabsky, which are going to be appearing on ITV in the next few weeks. We'll be getting an update on the Steam Tug Challenge, which is one of the remaining little ships left over from the Dunkirk evacuation, and which a couple of years ago was given a major overhaul in Shoreham Harbour. And we'll also be getting to know a new host to this programme, who's going to be taking over from me in hosting some future editions. So I need to start by saying that I've got a guest in the studio today. Although he's not really that much of a guest. You've heard him before doing various reports for us over the last two or three years. It's Chris English.
Good morning, or hello.
Hi, Chris. And I gather we're going to just co-present this programme for a change rather than it just being me.
Well, we thought, didn't we, that it would relieve some of the pressure on you and also allow me to spread my wings, as it were.
Yes, so this time round, Chris and I are going to be working together, and in a few weeks' time, Chris is going to have a go at presenting the programme all on his own. And then,
yes, a bit daunting.
And then hopefully we'll be able to alternate. But we'll see how it goes. I first met Chris many years ago when we both used to work for BBC Radio Brighton. I was actually an engineer there on the staff, and Chris, you were one of the freelance contributors, weren't you?
Yes, I was one of Bob Gunnell's people that came in off the street, community broadcaster, and that was the start of my career. Basically, as people who've heard some of the interviews that I've been doing for Grey Matters and At Home This Morning, talking about water sports. The programme at those days was called Sea Sports and BBC Radio Brighton, and that had various names, On the Waterfront, and several others in probably about 20-odd years that I presented that programme, different times, Friday evenings, Sunday mornings, whatever. So that was how I got into broadcasting.
Because your full-time job was actually working for Seaboard, wasn't it?
Yes, I was an electrical engineer, and I'd worked for Seaboard until I retired, about 40 years. And because of my involvement with the BBC, they suddenly realised they'd got this sort of round peg in a square hole, and they took advantage of my so-called abilities, and my career really took off, and that was all down to the advent of local radio broadcasting.
Right, well, we'll talk a bit more about that later on in the programme, but you've actually brought in an interview that you've done. Perhaps you'd like to introduce it.
Thank you, Richard. And if you've been down to Brighton Marina lately, you'll have seen there's another new building. This time it's the headquarters of Brighton Lifeboat. And at a ceremonial opening, I went down there, stood in the boathouse. You can tell that because of the noises in the background. And I spoke to Richard Pearce and asked him what his position actually was in the RNLI.
I'm a launching authority, or one of them.
What does that mean, first of all?
Well, a launching authority for the lifeboat. It's the go-between between the Coast Guard, which are government, and the Coast Guard are responsible for search and rescue all around our coastline. The RNLI is a charity, so you can't really have the government controlling a charity. There has to be that go-between. So it doesn't delay things, but if the Coast Guard require the lifeboat, they actually page our pagers. It comes up as a launch request message on our pagers. All the crew get that, and they all start moving because they know something's happening. And I will then ring the Coast Guard, and we can have a quick discussion on what they need us for. And because of my local knowledge, I'll probably be able to perhaps advise them that we might need a bigger lifeboat, we might need a helicopter, It's very rare for me to say no, but there may be a situation where, because of local sea conditions or exceptionally low tides at our marina entrance, it may be just completely dangerous or unwise for us to even think about going and to try and get New Haven or Shoreham lifeboat to come along.
You talked about local knowledge. You were a beachmaster, weren't you, before you retired?
I was involved with Brighton Council Seafront Office and also with the lifeguard patrol boat and all the lifeguards that the council has from Saltdean right the way down to Hove Lagoon. I'm still involved in it in a semi-retired state, and I get quite involved with keeping the maintenance going and watching over the servicing of the smaller lifeguard patrol boat, which does a fantastic job, and it actually stops the lifeboat here being called out to silly little things like kids in rubber rings a few metres offshore.
And that is owned by the council, isn't it?
That is completely owned by the council. But it's, I like to think we have a good, I'm the go-between between the council and the lifeboat, the RNLI service, so that we can both support one another. And in fact, the RNLI here do give permission for the lifeguards running the patrol boat just to use the facilities here at the lifeboat station through the summer.
We'll talk about the brand new lifeboat station in a moment, but something the general public don't often see is we're actually down here with the lifeboat. Describe it for us.
Well, this lifeboat is actually the latest. It's called a semi-rigid inflatable, but it weighs about 2 tonnes. It's 8.5 metres long, possibly slightly longer than that, actually, because that 8.5 metres is the bit that sits in the water. It has twin 115 horsepower engines on it. That gives it, it can probably do 100 miles before, it starts running out of fuel. It does about 35 knots, which is possibly getting up to 40 miles an hour miles per hour.
And in water terms, that's very fast, isn't it?
It is very fast, yes. And for coping with sea conditions, strangely enough, it can actually scoop up seawater and keep it in the front part of the boat, the bow, in order to give it more nose weight, which is really useful for trying to get out of our marina entrance, which can be extremely rough.
It can be very dodgy, aren't they? Now, the boat, you can't help but notice, is a mass of electronics.
It is, yes. They really have gone to town on it now. And in fact, what we have now on the boat almost equals to what some of the bigger boats like at New Haven and Shoreham have got on board. We've got radio direction finding, we have the latest electronic maps, and we have radar on there. Even the radio, you push a button. If you didn't quite get what somebody said to you last time, you can push a button and it'll sort of repeat itself. Yes, yeah, it's quite amazing, yes.
And so all of that in a slightly hostile environment of salt water, you'd think the two don't go together.
It does suffer sometimes, but we've actually got a brilliant lot of mechanics, the RNLI employ, that go around keeping it maintained. And always crews send feedback on how that can be improved. And it is really now state of the art, yes, yeah.
And how old is this boat?
This boat is actually, I think, possibly about 2 or 3 years old.
It looks brand new.
It does, yes, because all lifeboats have a refit very regularly. They go back to the boatyards and they're completely, refitted, stripped out. And there is actually a fleet of relief boats, which people have actually raise money and donated just for a relief boat, and these actually just travel the country backing up boats where this happens, where boats have to go back for refit.
You talked earlier about you're the launching authority. Now, all the crew are volunteers, aren't they?
Yes, yeah, we're all volunteers, including myself, and we don't get paid for it at all. So, which I think makes it better, because people join because they want to do it, not because they're getting paid for it.
I was going to say why.
You know, why put your lives at risk in an extremely uncomfortable situation?
It is, but actually, with the equipment that the RNLI supply, it takes the danger away from it. I must admit, I do admire when you see these old pictures where they went out rowing in oilskins and they were gone on a simple call out and they were gone for days and days sometimes, even though it was down the coast or they had to get a team of horses to pull the boat over land. We've actually got it quite easy in these day and age because the equipment is actually so good.
And how much would a boat like this cost?
I'm not absolutely too sure on that one. I think it's over £200,000, but I couldn't give you an exact figure.
But a lot of money.
An awful lot of money.
I mean, you can buy something like an 8-metre rib, which is basically what this is, for at a boat show for about £50,000 or £60,000, can't you? So what makes this one different?
It's really everything that's gone into it, and because everything is double the strength on it. Everything has been looked at, has been tested, and everything that comes into making the boat is looked at and tested before it's fitted onto the boat. In some cases, it's even weighed to make sure that the centre of gravity and all the balance is correct for the boat.
Richard, thank you.
No problem.
While I was in the new building, I ventured into the equally new shop and spoke to Margaret Kimber and asked her how vital fundraising activities like the shop were to the RNLI.
Fundraising is vitally important. It's their only means of raising money to pay for the amazing equipment that they have. They have the very best of equipment in terms of boats, their kit. Without that, they wouldn't get volunteers who risk their lives. These people know that their kit will keep them afloat, warm, dry, and anything else.
And safe, presumably.
And safe, yes.
Now, I've talked about the shop. What exactly have you got in terms of stuff in the shop?
We have a variety of things. We have Christmas cards, calendars and diaries at this time of the year. In the summer months, we have things for the beach, buckets and spades, nets, the like, and we also have general stationery, some mugs, children's toys, and just general gifts for people to take home or use as may be to support the RNLI.
And these are all branded RNLI items, aren't
they? They're all branded RNLI items, and 60% of the cost goes directly to the RNLI.
And is this the main fundraising activity in RNLI? I mean, what else can people do to support?
The main fundraising activity at the moment are legacies. 6 out of 10 launches are dependent on legacies, but as we all know, legacies are going to reduce with the lack of pensions and other things. So they are looking more and more and relying more and more on the generosity of people through collecting in supermarkets, the pledges, which is a very, very good way of helping when you haven't got time to give, to donate, to raise money, where people pledge so much per shout. Now, for example, this year, Brighton has had almost 70 shouts. If people do £1 a shout, that's £70 that it will have cost them. But it is a very easy way of helping raise money for the RNLI.
And how do people find out more about taking out a pledge?
For the local area, they need to contact Margaret Minsky, who is the secretary of the Brighton fundraising branch. Her details will be on the Brighton Lifeboat website, and or if not, just contact Brighton Lifeboat website itself, send an email to them and they will forward it on to her, and she will be able to send the forms and what's necessary.
Or come here to the shop.
Or come here to the shop, where we're at the moment, we're only open at the weekends 10 till 3. We hope in the new year to extend this when we get more volunteers to help in the shop. We've opened from October this year really as a soft opening to see how things would go, because we only had 2 volunteers to help.
Now, you talk about volunteers. Richard was earlier talking about the crew. These are
other volunteers, aren't they, in the shop? And is there any limitation? I mean, a lot of people listening to this programme are perhaps older, shall we say, kindly. Are those the sort of people?
Yes, anybody can volunteer. It's time is of the essence, of course. We're looking to do probably a three-hour shift, 10 till 1 and then 1 till 4, especially during the summer months. The conditions are very pleasant. You've got a lovely view of the marina, warm. We've got disabled access and facilities all required that you need. So, yes, really any age. We have a student who's volunteered who's coming down at the weekends, which is very nice. Again, she has to be of, I think it's over 17. But anybody with a few hours to spare, it would be most welcome if they would like to volunteer. And for that, they contact Janice Dykes, come down to the lifeboat shop, and we can give over or the station and give the details over.
And if we're talking about elderly people or older people coming to help, presumably there's no heavy lifting involved or anything like that?
No lifting at all. All that is done by the shop manager or the crew helpers. And no, there is nothing strenuous at all. It's all very easy. As I say, even compared with the old days when the old shop, it's much easier.
And importantly, for anybody that hasn't been to the marina for a while, where exactly is the lifeboat station and the shop? Because they were separate before, weren't they?
They were separate, and now we're together. It helps considerably. To find it, you get to Wetherspoons, the West Quay pub at Wetherspoons, and then walk along towards the sea, towards the Brazilian restaurant, and on the left-hand side you'll see an unusual-shaped building, and that is the lifeboat station, and the shop is just on the end of it. And within the shop, in the new year, we will have a visitor centre where children will be able to be dress up as crew. There are going to be activity sheets and activities for them, and for more senior members, there is going to be a history time wall pertinent to the Brighton lifeboat, linked also with the RNLI itself, and a webcam on the boat so that you can see the boat, and footage of rescues and the like, so it will be an active part as well.
And I know it's early days and you've only got two volunteers at the moment. Hopefully some will come from this piece. But what sort of hours do you expect the shop to be open?
Well, we hope it will be open from 10 till 4 most days of the week, which, as I say, is two shifts, 10 till 1 and 1 till 4. Ideally, it would be nice to have two people on every shift, because one person might be giving them guidance in the visitor centre and another person in the shop, but we can run on one person in the shop if necessary.
And the lifeboat here to stay in Brighton?
Oh, definitely, yes. Yes, it's an essential part of Brighton, and the marina. I think the marina's success is dependent on the lifeboat being here. The sailors know that there's somebody there to get them at a moment's notice.
Margaret, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris English was talking to Margaret Kimber and before that Richard Pearce, both of the RNLI, on the occasion of the opening of the new Brighton lifeboat station in the marina. Well, if you've been listening to this programme at home this morning for a few years, you may remember that a year or so back we talked to local filmmaker Phil Grabsky. Phil produces films on the subjects of the great painters of the past, a series which goes under the name of Exhibition on Screen, and the great composers of the past. He used to work in television, but found there was an insufficient market for the sort of films that he makes in television, so he's moved over to making films for the cinema. Over the last few years, these have been regularly shown at cinemas such as the Duke of York's and the Commedia. Well, just recently, I found out that some of his films, five to be precise, on the subject of great artists of the past, are going to be shown on ITV. Well, this is getting his films out to a wider audience than they will normally receive on cinema showings. So it must be something quite important for Phil, and I invited him to come into the studio and tell me about it. When he came in, I began by saying to him that I thought this was something of a coup for him.
This is something quite exciting for us, actually, that the exhibition on screen cinema series, they're 85-minute films usually, they go into the cinemas. We've now reversioned them as 50-minute films, and they're going out on ITV, which is a bit of a coup, under the title of Great Art, and they're playing on Thursday evenings after the 10 o'clock news. That's fantastic for us because I have to say there's no better place to see a film than in the cinema. But, you know, it's easy to miss or, you know, not have the opportunity to go to the cinema on the particular nights that our films are showing. So then to be on ITV and their catch-up service as well means that we'll go from, you know, when we do well in the cinema, that's 10 to 15,000 people will see them over a course of two nights, which is very good. ITV, of course, is 500,000, 1 million, 1.5 million. So it's great for us to be able to bring our films to a wider audience.
Yes, presumably you'll pick up a lot of people who wouldn't actually go to the cinema to see your films, but if they come up on TV, they might well watch them.
The way in which we watch television these days has changed enormously. You know, when I was growing up, we had four channels. In fact, three at first, and then four, and then five. But, I mean, it's only 30-odd years since Channel 4 started. So, you know, things have changed very rapidly in the last few decades. But nevertheless, you still have these major channels, and there are still millions and millions of people who look first to ITV for the kind of programmes they want to watch. I think it's a great thrill that, you know, we're going to be there with Coronation Street, we're going to be there with Emmerdale. There are millions of people who have chosen to watch News at 10 on ITV as opposed to on the BBC. So, you know, we hope we inherit an audience.
Yes, in a sense, you're following in Melvyn Bragg's footsteps.
Well, we are, actually, because I think it's rather shameful that our TV stations as a whole, our broadcasting landscape as a whole, doesn't give art the attention it deserves, with the exception of BBC Four. ITV has never done a huge amount of art, but it did used to have the flagship show of the South Bank show with Melvyn Bragg on a Sunday night. That was cancelled a few years ago. They replaced it with something called Perspectives. Now, Perspectives did have some good films within it, but was still this idea that for people to be engaged with art, somehow it had to be associated with a celebrity. So what they did was they would have a celebrity name talking about an artist that they apparently were very interested in. Some of those films I thought worked better than others. The problem is it was neither fully a film about a celebrity or fully a film about the artist. It was a bit of a mishmash sometimes. Anyway, they did five seasons, and then that was, I guess, came to the end of its life. And then there was a period for about 2 years when ITV has shown no art whatsoever, which I think is a real shame. And that's where we've come in with Great Art. First episode is the 4th of January on Canaletto. If that's missed, as I say, it's available on catch-up. And then January 11th, the next one is going to be a film about the Impressionists. And it's a really interesting film about the man behind the Impressionist movement. Then we have a film about Rembrandt, a film about Goya, and a film about one of the most famous paintings in the world, Girl with a Pearl Earring.
Sounds very interesting. And as you say, long overdue for ITV to put something like that on the air.
My view is that art is just as much a part of our cultural tapestry as any other thread you can choose to illustrate this by, whether it's location shows or celebrity shows or cooking shows or quiz shows. I think shows about art are just as important.
I know you've made films on various subjects in the past, but these days you tend to specialise in the lives of the great composers and also the great artists.
For me, any film, whether it's the latest Star Wars or an exhibition on screen, it's all about storytelling. And I don't distinguish between a documentary or a fiction film or an animation film. Good films are good storytelling. Bad films are bad storytelling. And I've seen films that have cost hundreds of millions of dollars And I just think they're pretty weak because the storytelling is weak. And I've seen films that have cost under $1 million, which have been absolutely fantastic. In fact, even sometimes costing less than that because the storytelling is so strong. So for me, and this has been true since my very first film, it's all about telling the story. I think if I have a skill, it's that I'm able to absorb an awful lot of information, do a lot of research, talk to a lot of people, and then precise that information into an 85-minute film, or if it's going on television, a 50-minute film, in a way that is accessible, intelligent, talks to an audience that perhaps don't know anything about the subject, and also talks to an audience that does know something about the subject. So when we come to an exhibition like, for example, there's a fantastic exhibition on at the moment at the National Portrait Gallery about Cézanne, Cézanne's portraits. That was the basis of our current film about Cézanne. For me, then, it's about an 85-minute cinema film about the life of Cézanne, which is using the elements of that exhibition. So each film has three core parts. One, we show you the exhibition in as good a way as we possibly can, with steady cams, with tracks, with, you know, beautifully shot, and so on. We have the curators talking to us about the paintings, historians, experts. Whether you've seen the exhibition or not, it's the wonderful way to really look at these paintings and understand them. Secondly, we go behind the scenes a little bit at the gallery itself. We do this differing ways for differing films. Sometimes we see the scientific analysis of a painting or the reframing of a painting or the curators with their little models of the gallery sticking the paintings, little miniature paintings on the wall of their little doll's house to decide where paintings are going to go, things like that. And then, crucially, the third element is the biography of the artist. So with Cézanne, we did a lot of filming in the south of France, around Aix-en-Provence. We got into the places where he lived, the places where he worked, places where he painted. And that's very, very important. We let you look at the paintings. We show you the paintings in detail that you won't otherwise have seen. And we have the world's experts explaining to you why, in the case of Cézanne, he is considered to be, and there are a few people who are called the father of modern art, but certainly Cézanne has a genuine case to be one. And we commission a score. We take an awful lot of time in terms of grading the pictures so they look exactly how they would look in the gallery, so on and so forth. So it's storytelling. And all of our films do that. So whether it's Canaletto, which has already gone out recently, coming up, we have in the cinemas repeats. You know, we've had popular demand to repeat a film we made about Van Gogh, a film we made about Monet. All the films are different, but all of them have that core ingredient of as storytelling as we can possibly make, giving you the ability to really look at the paintings. And I have to say, for us, the audience reaction is always so strong. We get lots of reactions on Facebook and emails and phone calls and things like that. Our biggest challenge really is, even after 6 years of doing this, is just making people aware that if they keep an eye on, for example, in Brighton, keep an eye on the Commedia, just to see when an exhibition on screen film's coming. And again, that's perhaps why, you know, we had to make a decision. Did we want to have 50-minute versions of the films going on television? But in the end, we decided yes. And part of that is that we hope people will watch the films on television and then think, oh, actually, well, one, I'm going to go and buy the DVD of the full-length version from 7th-art.com website. Or two, I'm going to make sure I go and see the films in the cinema, the new films, when they come out.
I was talking to local filmmaker Phil Grabsky about the series of films that he made on the subject of great art, and the series is actually called Great Art, which are coming up on ITV on Thursday evenings at 10:45. The series has actually already started because the first programme was on January the 4th and was on the subject of Canaletto. However, you can catch up with this on the ITV catch-up service via the internet, and the series continues, with the next programme being on January the 11th and the final programme being on February the 1st. You can also find Phil's films in local cinemas, particularly the Duke of York's and the Commedia, and in the cinema they run for 85 minutes rather than the 50 minutes that they are on the television. You can find out details about them by going to their website, which is Exhibition on Screen. Well, as I said earlier, we're going to talk a bit more to Chris English about his experience in broadcasting. And Chris, that was pretty well all gained at what, when I was there, was BBC Radio Brighton, but it later became BBC Sussex, didn't it?
It did indeed. And that was really when I got more into the broadcasting. And I used to go out in the radio car on Saturdays. I used to be the technical producer for the Saturday afternoon sports programmes, election programmes, children in need, all of those sort of things. I used to do what you're doing here, which was drive the desk. So that was my involvement. And I used to enjoy that thoroughly. I'm not so sure my family did because I was missing a lot of the time, including Christmas mornings when I was again out in the radio car. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it all came to an end when the BBC had one of its moments and rationalised local radio and amalgamated Radio Sussex with Radio Surrey and sold the building or didn't renew the lease, in actual fact, on the building in Marlborough Place in Brighton. And everything moved to Surrey. Well, coupled with the thought of driving to Guildford every time I wanted to do a programme, or was wanted to do a programme, and a dramatic increase in my full-time workload meant that something had to go, and I'm afraid it was broadcasting. And it wasn't until I was approached by Grey Matters, by Colin Vincent, to come in and talk about a project I was involved in locally, that I got back into it.
Yes, that was quite a coincidence, really, because you came in as an interviewee to start off with, talking about the, what's it, the Steam Tug Challenge, was it?
Steam Tug Challenge, which had lain in what's known as Southwick Canal, but it's the bottom of Boundary Road in Hove. She sat down there on a wharf, looking very sad and becoming increasingly sad. And because, as you know, I'm involved in all things boating, and I stuck my head around the corner one day and soon found myself involved. And there was a lottery grant, and she was put back to sea. But there's a story there, and we can move that on in the future, I think.
OK, well, let's have a listen to that first interview that you did as an interviewee before you'd had your arm twisted to join us as a presenter and a regular interviewer. It was back in 2014 when you came into the studio to talk to Colin Vincent about the Steam Tug Challenge. Here's what you said.
The Tug Challenge was built in 1931, and basically as one of the hundreds at that time of tugs that worked on the River Thames. She, like every vessel that was built in those days, was coal-fired and steam-powered. And that existed until fairly late in her career. But the reason she's special is that she was one of the fleet of boats, in fact, probably the largest non-naval vessel that took part in what is known as Operation Dynamo, which was the evacuation of 300,000+ troops from the beaches of Dunkirk. Challenge was in the thick of it, but made lots of trips backwards and forwards between either the beaches, Dover or Ramsgate, of course, was the other port that she went into. So that's her claim to fame, and that enabled us to apply for a lottery grant from the Heritage Lottery Fund to replace the boiler, because, as I said initially, the boiler was built like the rest of the ship in 1931, and by the sort of 1990s had come to the end of its life, despite being looked after very well as a working vessel, which was converted to oil firing in the 50s. So it meant a new boiler. Well, this is a fairly huge piece of equipment, and it meant to replace the boiler meant cutting the whole of the upper deck off. And that was then lifted off with the funnel and the masts on the quayside in Shoreham. The old boiler was cut up in situ and went for scrap. The new boiler was then craned in and the deck put back on and all the pipework connected. That description took probably a few seconds, but the work took nearly 2 years. So that's a potted history, if you like. Right.
And its relationship with the trust, is it owned by the trust?
Well, after she finished her service, she was exhibited, is probably not the right word. Dumped might be another one, in what is now St. Catherine's Yacht Harbour, which was then being developed by Taylor Woodrow into both the yacht harbour and the old warehouses converted into flats and hotels and that sort of, one of the earliest marinas. And she was an attraction, in inverted commas, if you like. And she stayed there. And although there was a group of people, they didn't really have very much to do. And eventually she got to the state where she was going to be scrapped. And the Dunkirk Little Ships Restoration Trust, to give it its full title, stepped in and bought her for £1. She towed her down to Tilbury, where some initial work was done. The boiler was re-steamed after being examined to make sure it was safe. She then was towed to Southampton and slipped at Marchwood, which is the military base in Southampton Water. And lots of the underwater plating was replaced. And that's how she continued. But she is owned by the Dunkirk Little Ships Restoration Trust. Everybody concerned with Challenger is a volunteer. There are no paid staff whatsoever. Even when she goes to sea, whilst we have to have qualified seamen to operate a master and a chief engineer, nobody gets paid. And in fact, in the past, they've had to pay for their own transport to whichever port she happens to be in, and their Vitalin, their food and drink, really. So, I mean, it's been basically run as a sort of gentleman's club with a number of people who've sort of put their hands in their pockets. And obviously, that can't continue. If she's going to have a future, which she must have, particularly with the 75th anniversary of the evacuation of Dunkirk coming up next year in 2015, she must go. Along with the other ship, and that, as talked about, this £12,000 a year, but there are other costs as well. She costs, for example, if she's tied up alongside and open to the public with all the machinery running, or a steam machine running, that costs £20 an hour in fuel oil just to power the boiler for that time. To go anywhere under her own power, you're probably talking five times that, £100 an hour in terms of steaming. So if you're doing a 10-hour voyage, it's going to cost £1,000. It's the very basic arithmetic.
Well, that was Chris back in 2014 talking to Colin Vincent about the Steam Tug Challenge. So, Chris, what developments have there been since then?
Well, the lottery grant was very successful, and she was restored in Shoreham and sailed off magnificently down to Southampton, because there were great plans for her in Southampton. Unfortunately, they never came to anything, and she languished there. The people from Shoreham who used to go down, the engineering team, used to go down and spend weekends on her and looking after her, and they got fed up with it. It all culminated, really, when she wasn't able to go to the 75th anniversary of the Dunkirk rescue, Operation Dynamo, because of a situation with the trustees who owned it. And she basically has been left to rot in Southampton Docks. Something that wasn't particularly pleasing to the owners of Southampton Docks, Associated British Ports, who late last year gave the trustees notice that she had to be moved, she wasn't welcome anymore. And not her, just her, but other historic ships in Southampton. And so the hunt was on for somewhere to take her. Initially, that was Hull Marina, where she was never based. It's a completely alien place as far as Challenger was concerned. However, things moved on from that. And just before Christmas, we heard that she had got a new base on the River Thames, where she belongs, and that she had been bought. The trustees had sold her for what they paid for, £1. She's to go to a popular public base that's known as Trinity Buoy Wharf on the Thames. It's the other side of the Thames from the Dome and the O2 Arena. It's on a landing from the passenger vessels that ply up and down the Thames. So the future looks good. She's going to have all the boiler examinations, the hull examinations that is needed before she can be moved. That's underway. So hopefully, before too long, she'll be back in steam and back where she belongs.
And will she be able to actually go out to sea under her own steam?
Well, that's the plan. That's the plan. One of the problems with her, as far as a public are concerned, is that she is not able to take passengers. There is no passenger accommodation. And as such, the Board of Trade, or whatever they're called these days, won't allow her to be used for passenger-carrying services. But she can be in steam, she can run, she can visit other ports, she can go back to Dunkirk. Of course, Dunkirk is big news now because of the film, which is, I must say, remarkably well done. And a lot of the action, for anybody that's seen the film, and if not, why not, you must go and see it or buy the DVD, is based on the mole in Dunkirk Harbour. And that was where Challenge was based. And it's a tragedy that she wasn't able to take part in the film because she wasn't operational at the time. But she will go back. I'm sure she'll go back for the 80th anniversary and hopefully the 100th as well.
Yes, let's hope so. Are you still connected with her at all?
Well, the people that carried out the restoration in Shoreham Harbour became known as the Shoreham crew. They were the people that went down when she was based in Southampton. And we still meet on a Friday afternoon for a drink. We are loosely connected, and some of us are still members of the Dunkirk Little Ships Restoration Trust and get their newsletters. So, yes, I would like to think that when she's restored, I'll be able to renew my association with her.
Well, do please come and tell us, obviously.
I look forward to that.
Thanks very much, Chris. Well, we're just coming to the end of this unusual programme, in that it's been presented by both me and Chris English, and it seems to have gone remarkably well, actually. So, that's good hope for the future on the Grey Matters front as well. Thanks for your help, Chris. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which, as I usually say, we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. It now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme, to thank everyone who's taken part, and especially Chris English. And, as I say, you'll be hearing a lot more of him in a few weeks' time when he starts presenting programmes on his own. But you haven't heard the last of me. Chris and I are going to do alternate programmes, so you'll be hearing both our voices if you keep listening. Well, the clock has caught up with us, so I now just need to bid you farewell and wish you all the very best. From Chris and from me and from everyone else at Grey Matters Productions, goodbye.